It was a 10-year friendship between the Mr. Mace and Mr. Domash. Approximately 7 years into that friendship, they had a couple of problems that they could help each other on. Mr. Domash was trying to leave Fidelity Investments, start his own investment company. He was in the middle of a divorce. My client had lost his job, but he was trying to start his own insurance company and needed a means of support and a means to pay a relative he was supporting. At that point, they entered into a verbal agreement. Mr. Domash, in exchange for getting Mr. Mace's help as a personal assistant and for his guarantee that Mr. Domash would be the investment advisor for this insurance company, Mr. Domash agreed to pay Mr. Mace for his costs and expenses for any work that he did as a personal assistant and for any work that he did in trying to start this insurance company and for trying to support this niece. Everything went pretty much fine for a couple of years. What went wrong with this verbal agreement is that the payment was going to be, the final payment in accounting was going to occur when Mr. Domash's divorce was final. And that divorce lasted a lot longer than expected. It's fact it didn't end until 2008. In November of 2002, Mr. Domash, for the first time in writing, verbally denied that he ever entered into this contract. Subsequently, this case was filed. The first issue is the summary judgment. Your Honor, if you look at the our issue on that is that given that the court allowed the breach of contract case to go to trial, I don't really see how the summary judgment could have been allowed. This is a verbal agreement. Anytime you have a breach of a verbal agreement, it almost goes without saying that the quasi-contract remedies are a fallback. If there is no contract, but one party definitely relies on the other party on this verbal agreement, you always seek a quasi-contract remedy. The court even admitted in its decision that my client was seeking reliance damages, but when it went to the final count dealing with the quasi-contract relief, for some reason the court just concentrated on the quantum merit remedy that the trial attorney was seeking as an alternative. For some reason, it completely forgot about the reliance damages. I know opposing counsel argues.
Did he allowed reliance damages in quasi contract?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Has DC allowed reliance damages in quasi-contract? Is that a theory that exists in the DC?
To my understanding, it is, Judge. I've cited numerous cases, and it's basic quasi-contract law, reliance damages. Essentially, in quasi-contract, you can collect the same damages as you can as a contract. Most of the time, parties seek prospective damages, but even in contract cases, when prospective damages fail, you fall back on reliance, and that's what was going on here. The trial attorney in the summary judgment memo clearly argued reliance damages. He didn't repeat it on count three, which is what the appellees are relying on the argument on the count three issue. The trial attorney was aggressive, was trying to bring in quantum merit damages and argued on that. He didn't repeat the reliance argument, but it was definitely there. And if you look at the judge's summary judgment decision, the trial judge acknowledged that to be there by his decision, because it was in the statement of facts, not in the summary of the decision. In the statement of facts, he says the plaintiff's damages are reliance damages. That's what he's seeking. So essentially, that's our argument. If there was a sufficient questions of fact for the breach of contract to go to trial, there was definitely same questions of fact for the quasi-contract issues to go to trial. On the trial issue, the trial court vacated the jury's verdict. It's not exactly clear why. This happens at so many trials. The defense counsel came up with a boilerplate motion that argues everything, and plaintiff's counsel did what they could to oppose it at trial, and the judge simply granted the motion without stating specifically why they granted the JNOV.
I thought he stated why. The contract was too indefinite. There was not sufficient agreement as to all the material terms. There was insufficient evidence of an intent to be bound, all of essentially going to the same point, which was this was a vague oral promise, not the kind of contract that courts will enforce.
It was a general decision, essentially just going along with the defendant's motion, and it's just hard for me to argue with something like that because there's so many. I don't want to. I know the court has the whole trial transcript before it, but in any type of verbal agreement, you're always going to have ambiguity and vague. I think the best example, the trial attorney brought it up himself, the contingent fee situation. I, for example, have a contingent fee case that's now going into its 10th year. It's gone through one trial, one mistrial, three appeals. I still haven't gotten paid on it, and my client hasn't gotten anything, and it may go on for another 10 years.
I'm not sure what that has to do with vagueness and indefiniteness.
Well, the defendant,
you've got presumably an arrangement that says you're going to get X percent.
Right. And a contingent.
That's not vague.
Well, it's vague
it's
in
contingent,
the sense.
But you know what it's contingent on. I don't see the parallel to what happened here.
Well, it's contingent on the resolution of litigation. And when's that litigation going to resolve? It hasn't resolved in the last 10 years. It may not resolve in the next 10. And
forget about your analogy and go back to this case.
All right, well, in this case, the contract was going to resolve on the completion of a divorce. The divorce they thought was going to end a lot earlier than it did. So maybe a better analogy would be if you wind up in a situation where you have unwritten contingent fee agreement. For example, if a contingent fee is wrong or they forget to put it in writing, this sometimes happens. So you're in a situation where you're quantum merit arguing for fees based on a litigation result that may or may not ever happen. So I submit that just because the verbal contract was contingent on a divorce ending at some point in the future, it doesn't make it ambiguous. That's part of the problem of verbal agreements. It's you're never going to get a perfect verbal agreement. I know the appellee's argument, they concentrate on some portion of trial testimony where he says my client knew he was going to get paid when the divorce ended because that's when Mr. Domash was going to be emotionally stable. But if you look at the context of that testimony, you see, that was an explanation as to why they picked that endpoint. They picked the endpoint of a divorce ending because at that point he was going to be emotionally stable. Everything was going to be end. They can concentrate on starting the insurance company. They can concentrate on starting the investment company. And that's a very reasonable explanation. Unfortunately, that endpoint didn't happen until a lot of years later. In terms of damages, there was definite testimony by my client as to what credit cards he was using, what he was spending on, the amounts. It was his testimony under oath. That's all a credibility issue. The credit cards all have set interest rates. It's a natural problem with any verbal agreement. The jury definitely looked at everything and came up with a figure that was a figure that no one expected, so you can't say that the jury didn't do their job. They deliberated for a couple of days, and they came up with a set figure, and I know the appellees argued that it doesn't make sense, but the reality is that if you give the same verdict to 500 different juries, you're going to come up with 500 different verdicts. The point is it's a social. Our society lets juries decide problems between their fellow citizens or their fellow members of society. It's not supposed to be the judge's job to resolve these situations except in rare circumstances. And the jury did that here. They took a very difficult case with half a dozen witnesses covering testimony spanning at least 4 years, some of it going back 10 years. There were over 100 exhibits. There was testimony from damages from $10,000 to $250,000. These 12 citizens sit down. They did their job. They looked over this stuff as members of the society. They passed a verdict on their fellow citizens, and I submit that's how it's supposed to work. You can't assume that they didn't do their job just because to defense counsel, the verdict doesn't make any sense. Really, unless the court has any more questions, I'll rely on the paperwork.
Thank you, counsel.
All right, thank you, Judge.
May it please the court. My name is Doug Brooks. I represent the appellee, Larry Domash. Mr. Mace's argument on the first issue, the summary judgment dismissal of the quantum merit unjust enrichment claim, seems to be that, as he said on oral argument, that it goes without saying that in cases of contract, there's always a fallback provision of some kind of quasi-contract. I submit that the law is contrary to that. It doesn't go without saying. It's up to a party to say it. And he didn't say it. He did not make the argument that he's making now in opposition to summary judgment. And the law of the circuit is clear that it has therefore been waived. He exclusively argued on summary judgment as to the quantum merit unjust enrichment claim that he was seeking damages in to compensate him for the value of his services. This is a claim that he now expressly denies. He says that the contractor promise never contemplated this. In response to the Chief Judge's question, is there any case law in D.C. that reliance damages can be awarded in a case of quasi-contract? I was unable to find a single case where the term reliance damages was even mentioned in the context of quasi-contract. The cases cited by Mr. Mace exclusively deal with the term reliance damages in the context of express contracts. What his new claim really is just it's a claim for promissory estoppel. And the record's clear. If you go back and look at his memorandum in opposition of summary judgment as well as his oral argument, he never argued for promissory estoppel. He would have had a right, maybe would have needed to amend his complaint, but he never made the argument that he's trying to make now, which is in the event that the contract is ultimately held to be unenforceable, which it was, a fallback position that, well, I'm entitled to the alternative theory of promissory estoppel, which is a form of quasi-contract. Even without the waiver issue, though, the promissory estoppel suffers from the same problem as the breach of express contract. That is that it's hopelessly vague and indefinite. I mean, typically with the promissory estoppel, what's missing is consideration. And what courts do is they sort of, you're allowed to get around consideration if you can prove detrimental reliance. But the promise still has to be, and the case law is clear on this, the In Re Office Products case that's cited in the papers, the promise for a promissory estoppel case still has to be sufficiently definite. And it wasn't here. If you look at the key, and this goes to the contract too, if you look at the key provision of this either contract or promise, allegedly it was that Mr. Domash promised to repay Mr. Mace certain expenses upon the happening of three criteria. One was the end of his divorce proceedings. The court doesn't need to reach this, but even that may be too vague, because if you look at what Mr. Mace argued in his summary judgment papers, he argued that the divorce litigation ended some time ago, meaning years before 2008. Then at trial, he changed his argument to say that the divorce proceedings hadn't ended until 3 years after he filed this case. I think just the fact that he is unable to peg when the divorce proceedings ended is problematic. But again, that really doesn't need to be resolved here, because it's the other two criteria, right. It's the other two criteria that Mr. Mace specified that make it that was the reason that Judge Kennedy granted judgment as a matter of law, and that same applies to the promissory estoppel. It's that he said, contrary to what Mr. Mace now argues, Mr. Mace at trial testified that there were three separate criteria that needed to be met in order for the payment obligation under the alleged contract to arise. End of divorce proceedings. Number two is that Mr. Domash was emotionally able to focus on the insurance project. And to make it worse, he said, when asked, well, how would you know that happened? Well, whenever Mr. Domash told me. And the third criteria, and again, he specified these as separate criteria giving rise, triggering the payment obligation, was when Mr. Domash was comfortable with his own financial situation. Again, that comfort level was going to be a subjective test up to Mr. Domash. And that's the reason that that's one of the reasons that the trial court granted Mr. Domash judgment as a matter of law, and the same thing would apply to the promissory estoppel. In terms of the decision, the trial court's decision to grant judgment as a matter of law, again, Mr. Mace only challenges two of the five reasons. The judge gave five separate and independent reasons, and Mr. Mace only challenges two of them. And under the Jankovic decision that's cited in our papers, he's therefore waived it. One of the reasons which he did challenge was the statute of limitations. So I'd just like to briefly address that. It was a three-year statute of limitations, and in a case like this where there's an alleged reimbursement contract, the statute of limitations clock starts running when the payment is due. More than 3 years before Mr. Mace filed suit, he wrote Mr. Domash a letter, and this was a trial exhibit, and Mr. Mace confirmed that he wrote it, where he demanded payment under this alleged contract, which he said was overdue. So the payment was overdue more than 3 years before, and he demanded an immediate payment of $100,000. Mr. Mace also, more than 3 years before he filed suit, wrote a letter to a third party in which he claimed that Mr. Domash was deceitful, and at trial, when asked, you know, why was he deceitful, Mr. Mace said, well, he was deceitful because he hadn't paid me yet. I think it goes without saying, as the trial court found, that you can't be deceitful in not paying something if that payment isn't yet due. And in fact, Mr. Mace conceded this issue in his testimony at trial. He said, when asked when the payment became due under this alleged contract, he said it very well could have been more than 3 years before, as the trial judge found. And finally, Mr. Mace also has failed to challenge in his brief the trial court's ruling on damages, that they weren't provided with a reasonable amount of certainty. And again, this is an issue that Mr. Mace expressly conceded at trial. When asked how he came up with the figures that he was throwing around for what he thought he was owed under this alleged contract, he admitted that it was a, quote, approximation and speculation rather than any kind of accounting. And I understand that in some cases, exact amounts aren't necessary, but as the case law demonstrates, those are in cases where it would be impossible to provide an exact amount of damages because of the inherently vague nature. But here what you had was just a bunch of credit card expenses and the interest. I mean, a simple record keeping, he could have provided what he was owed. And he said he was unable to do that. In fact, he admitted that some of the damages that he was alleging, he couldn't be sure that they were actually expended during the alleged contract period. He admitted that he might be including some before the contract allegedly began, and that's because he didn't remember when this contract was allegedly formed. And again, at the end of the day, it's a non-issue anyway, because Mr. Mace did not challenge the trial court's ruling that he failed to present his damages beyond a speculative nature. And therefore, I think under the Jankovic decision, he really can't challenge the trial court's Rule 50 order anyway as a matter of law. And unless there's anything else, I will rest on the papers.
Okay, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, had a little time left.
Less than 30 seconds.
Okay, we'll round you up to 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel, if you wish.
The police counsel is picking and choosing statements from cross-examination to, you know, essentially attack the plaintiff's credibility. We can stay here all day and pick and choose cross-examination.
Address the statute of limitations issue, please.
Right. For one thing, what happened in 2002 was back and forth issue as to when payment was going to be made. It's typical during contracts, especially when parties are getting to the point where someone's going to start breaching, to argue when payments are going to be made. But it's clear that the payment was not due, in fact, until the divorce ended in 2008. So as trial counsel argued, there was an anticipatory breach issue here. The jury was instructed on that, and the jury found for the plaintiff on that. They found that there was no statute of limitations issue on that. And the trial courts, I mean, the trial attorney didn't waive anything. Again, this is your typical trial. Defense counsel came in with these paperwork, and the trial counsel opposed it the best they can verbally. There was nothing waived, and we haven't waived anything on appeal. And the damages issue is the same thing. Appellee's counsel picks and chooses cross-examination questions to try to attack the credibility of the plaintiff. You can do that with any trial, and we can spend all day here going to trial transcript. But the point is, the jury got to see all that. They got to see the cross-examination. They got to see these little picks that the appellee's counsel points out. They deliberated on everything. They looked at all the checks they had over the 100 exhibits, and they came out with a conclusion, Judge. And there was simply no reason for the trial judge to reverse that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.